So what we're dealing with here is just, this is what in this picture we see, a loincloth that would be rare in Jesus' time, but it is something that they might see a slave wearing out in the field working, or they might occasionally see someone in the Greek sections of the Decapolis maybe wearing them occasionally in very hot weather. But the Jewish people would not generally countenance walking about like this in Jesus' time. Now, then this is more typical of the clothing of Jesus' time. Now, on the left, I already introduced it to you, but this is what we would kind of call the inner tunic, which would basically be underwear, as their underwear. Are they wearing anything under that? And the answer is no, that's their underwear. Okay. Now, it would be a little bit like some of you ladies who wear a slip, you know, although the material is called a slip, I guess, because the cloth slips easily over it, but they would never call it a slip. But it was that type of a, it was an inner garment. It was made out of a softer cloth, a kind of a linen or a very soft wool, and it felt close to the skin. It was comfortable, and it was sometimes short. But by Jesus' time, most of the inner tunics had also longer sleeves than that. In that picture you're seeing, and they would tend to go down near to the ankles. Maybe not all the way to the ankles, but at least well down near the ankles. They tended to be longer, in other words, in Jesus' time. All right, now, over that inner tunic, they would wear an outer tunic, or sometimes called a mantle. All right, now, we're going to talk a little bit about the mantle in a minute. But regarding the inner tunic, if somebody was only wearing their inner tunic, they were said to be naked in the Bible. And I think I mentioned this to you last week, so let's just quickly remember it. But Peter's in the boat, remember? And Jesus on the shore. And it says, Peter threw on his garment and dived into the water, threw on his mantle. He was stripped, it says. He was naked, some of the translations say. He wasn't but naked. Right? The Jewish people were not at all happy about any public nakedness of any kind. You know, they just weren't happy about it. And you're not going to see that Peter wasn't but naked. He was wearing his inner tunic, probably something shorter that he could work. But he threw on his outer mantle because it wasn't considered respectable. Just show up. It's kind of like, you know, even today, you knock on somebody's door and a guy opens the door and he's wearing boxer shorts and a t-shirt. And he's like, well, he's not naked. But, you know, you don't really, that's a little rude to sort of walk around in just, you know, your boxer shorts and you know, your skivvies or whatever you call them, you know. So, you know, he's not naked, but it's not polite either. So, that's the kind of way that they might, right around the house, you know, they might kind of wear some of that. But anytime they would go out in public, they would always throw on some kind of an outer garment, all right? A kind of a throw-and-go tunic, all right? And so that on the right would be more, it's a very stylized thing, okay? And that should be recognizable to you in the way we pre-stress, right? And I don't go to the trouble today. I brought my alb again, but you get the idea. Just throw the alb on and put your belt and you're done, see? And you go out. A wonderfully cool way to dress. In a hot climate. By the way, has anyone ever, I asked you this last time, anyone have linen, real linen? I don't mean just sort of euphemistic linen, but I mean real linen clothing. It's wonderfully cool, isn't it? It breathes and it's cool. And it's like you feel like the temperature just went down 5 degrees when you put it on. If you go sell all you have and buy a linen shirt, it's just wonderful. I used to have linen albs for the hot summer months, and they just wrinkle so easily. So I just can't keep wearing them. But oh, they're wonderful, you know, wonderful garments. And so they would wear some linens and things, very nice, cool garments. And it breathes, and you know, we wear such tight-fitting clothing today, and we don't realize how hot that makes us. Okay.
All right. So moving on, we talked about this. Just some quick pictures of their clothes.
Typical of what you see around Palestine at the time of Jesus, this woman is wearing. Now, women didn't always wear veils all the time, and I'll talk about that later. But you can see that she's got a nice loose-fitting garment, that little cincture that the belt that gathers it in. In this case, she is wearing a veil. Sometimes women wore more like a bonnet. And she's using a kind of a wrap or a throw shawl there. And those were, you can't really see how here, but
They were very helpful when you went to the market. You could just tuck one in the end of your belt and you just start throwing stuff in. And it was like a bag. So you could just, so a lot of times they would throw these garments over the shoulders, wear them like a cloth, and then when they go to the market, they could just put stuff in them and carry it home. Or if it did get a little chilly, they could wrap it around the, you know, so it was a very useful little garment, sort of tuck in and carry with you. Okay. This is a man. Now, a man, you know, you sometimes see pictures of today of all these men wearing veils in Jesus' time. Men would occasionally, for prayer especially, put on these prayer shawls. And they would wear those. But men didn't wear a lot of veils from what everything we understand in Jesus' time. They did tend to wear these, sometimes these caps and things like that. But they would only wear these veils generally in a prayer setting. So there's a little bit of, we tend to get mistaken because we look at modern Arabs and Muslims and we think that's what, they dress like Jesus in Jesus' day. They not really. Now this is another example of Jesus. He's wearing his outer tunic and the inner tunic closer to his skin. And then he's wearing a kind of a mantle that doesn't have sleeves, but it's just that very helpful kind of a mantle that you can kind of put things in and tuck it into your belt and use it for other things. And you can, you know, use it for cooler weather. And you can, it's a useful kind of a garment. And that's a fairly kind of standard type of a thing. And again, you see no veil. Okay. And then just another quick example of how they kind of dress. Now this would be cooler. You can see they're wearing outer mantles. The man on the left there has a mantle with sleeves, and the man on the right is kind of just wearing a big scarf around his neck and so on. There were just different ways they could dress depending on the weather and so on. So I just leave that to your, you know, you can basically understand what's going on there. But you see the sleeves, this is something that would be almost like a large coat. Whereas this is more of a wrap, just throw it around your shoulders, and you can use it for other things. Yes, question. Yeah, it's hard to see there, but he would. Mm-hmm. Huh? You can't see it, but. What's that? Oh, sorry. She was wondering, just in this picture, is Jesus wearing an inner tunic? And I would say, well, I'm presuming he is. You just can't see it. Yeah, question.
What's with the beard?
What's with the beard?
Everybody wear beard.
Yeah. Well, yes, the Greeks and the Romans tended to shave their face,
right.
Whereas Jewish men tended not to. And it's just a cultural thing. Well, for Jewish men, a beard was a sign of wisdom. It was a sign of maturity. It was a sign of manhood. And they were proud of their beards. In fact, a lot of people in many parts of the world think a man without a beard is effeminate. I mean, shaving one's face, you know. Now, I didn't say they are. I'm just saying that's a cultural thing, you know. But almost all Jewish men did wear beards, yes. And still do. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Actually, I wouldn't say that all Jewish men wear beards. Yeah, maybe the traditional Jews. Now, we're going to get into foods now, okay? I do want to say a couple more things about clothing. Some of you ladies might be more interested in some of what I'm about to say about this. But in terms of the basics, men and women dress much alike. Let me just put this back to that other side. It'll help you. Okay. In terms of the basics, men and women dress much alike. However, clearly there were distinctions to be made since the scriptures warn in the book of Deuteronomy, a woman shall not wear a man's clothing. Nor shall a man put on a woman's clothing, for whoever does this is an abomination to the Lord. Hello. No transvestites there. And you might say, well, they seem to dress so much alike, but clearly there were distinctions that at least to their eyes were obvious. Okay? Now, what would be some of those differences? The exact differences are not clear. However, for the reason stated above, we can glean some ideas. Now, for example, there are some differences between the dress of men and women that I do make note of in my notes. For a woman, the inner garment was largely identical with a man's. However, the outer garment was usually a bit longer, with enough broader fringe with enough border and fringe to largely cover their feet. Isaiah talks about the importance of women kind of keeping their feet mostly covered in public. The outer garment had the same belt as a man, but usually was more richly and differently ornamented than a man's, all right? In some region, women's outer garments were also made of particular materials and patterns that were distinct from men's. Women might often don an apron as well to protect her outer garment when she was carrying things from the market. It was usually attached to her belt and covered the lower half of her body. Okay, more like an apron, like we would think today. All right. Now, regarding the veil, there's much debate on how widespread the wearing of the veil was for Jewish women at the time of Jesus. It's certain that they wore them in the synagogue and the temple, and you can read that in 1 Corinthians 11. It's also quite certain that unmarried women wore veils in public. Always, if you were unmarried, you always wore a veil in public. It is less certain, however, that Jewish women who were married wore them all the time in public, especially in the home. And even in public, it would seem that Jewish women in Roman Judea, namely down south near Bethlehem, wore hairnets, or like I showed you that little bonnet that it was worn by the woman in the picture. And these have been discovered uncovered in archaeological sites. So perhaps women did wear a veil women did not wear a veil at all times, as is now the custom in the Middle East. Other sources, though, do speak of a head covering being more usual for women and men than it is today, and they describe the length of cloth around the shoulders that could be pulled up over the head and tied on the forehead and would fall over the shoulders. So, in other words, sometimes women would have veils, but they'd wear them more back like a scarf, and then sometimes if it got cool or they wanted more modesty, they'd pull the veil up over their head, and sometimes it'd be more like a scarf around falling around their neck. Okay. Now, the Bible mentions women's jewelry. When Abraham's servants present earrings and bracelets to Rebekah. Jeremiah is also observed in his passages. He said, "Can a maid forget her ornaments?" Question mark. Likewise, Isaiah, there's a long passage in Isaiah that features a graphic picture of a fashionably ornamented woman of the Old Testament. As a general rule, Hebrew women wore bracelets. They wore earrings. Less commonly, they might have a nose jewel and a necklace. However, pay attention, bracelets. Bracelets were usually made of precious materials such as gold that were worn at the wrist. However, royal women more often wore them above the elbow, so richer women tended to wear them up on their above their elbow. Most bracelets were made of one piece and meant to slip over the wrist. More rarely, two pieces might have a hinge to be fastened. Now, here's another thing that you don't see a lot of, but very common among the Jewish women of that time is anklets. Women wore a lot of anklets, as commonly as they would wear bracelets. They were made of much the same material. Some anklets were made to have a tinkling musical sound when the women walked. Earrings. Pay attention, this is very interesting. It's something I learned. Among the Jewish people, only women wore earrings. Pay attention. Only women wore earrings. And more rarely, and they wore earrings much more rarely than women wear them today. Scriptures suggest that they were round or hoop-like. However, the law forbade all mutilation of the body, so the ears could not be pierced, and neither the nose could be pierced. To hold such earrings or jewels, things were usually clipped on, or more commonly were worn around the ear with a small chain. In other words, they'd basically be hung on the ear and hang low. So you'd hang them on the ear with a little chain, and it would hang that way. Okay, but they were not permitted to pierce their ears, certainly not to pierce their noses or other parts of their body. Just was not to be done. Likewise, absolutely no tattoos, any cuttings or markings or inkings on the body were strictly forbidden to the Jews.
That was in the law?
Yes, it's in the law.
Leviticus.
Yeah, you are not to make cuttings on your flesh, neither are you to tattoo your body. I am the Lord. That's what the text says, yes. Okay. Now, by the way, a lot of people say, well, how come then the Christian church doesn't forbid that today? Well, first of all, not everything in Leviticus is forbidden to us today. I mean, there's a lot of things in Leviticus that are no longer forbidden. So, in other words, it's hard to say there's a hard... Well, look, I just read it in the book of Leviticus. We're not supposed to do this. Well, I know, but it also says that men aren't to cut their hair above the ear in a certain way, and they're not to... You know, there's a lot of things that are said in Leviticus that just were customs that fell away, and some remained. Not all of them have the same force as serious, heavy moral law. Some of them are just more customary and are commanded at a certain point, but just for reasons of their own fell away. So we don't keep kosher laws. There's all kinds of forbiddance of things we're not. Some of you love crab. Some of you love lobster. You could not eat it if you're a Jew. You still can't eat it if you're a Jew. All right? You just can't. If a fish doesn't have scales, you ain't eating it. No eel for you, no snails, none of that stuff. It's not for you. But again, Jesus rendered all foods clean. So again, all of these are things that you have to remember. So I'm not here to say if you have a tattoo, you've sinned, or if you have a piercing. I would just say that I do have concerns personally for lots of these piercings. I'll just tell you my opinion. But I just don't think mucous membranes ought to be pierced. I think it's unhealthy. So if you're piercing noses and lips and stuff, I mean, I think it's probably okay to pierce a little earlobe. That's not a mucous membrane. But I think all these tattoos, frankly, just they're just unattractive. Which is unattractive. I just don't care for them. But personally, yeah. Yeah. What about wine? Yeah, we'll get to that. We're kind of getting into food a little bit ahead of time here, but wine is fine in moderation. It's drunkenness that's forbidden, not wine. And we'll see that in a minute. Obviously, Jesus drank wine. He even made the stuff. He was a great winemaker. All right. Okay. Now, therefore, regarding nose jewels, although some evidence exists of women wearing small jewels on or about the nose, there is no evidence that the wearing of them was common or widespread among Jewish women. The practice was more widespread to the east among the Assyrians and the Persians. In other words, they're in Iran, Syria, and Iraq, you know, into the Middle and Far East. That's where you see things. Regarding cosmetics and perfume, generally Jewish women looked at cosmetics such as painting the eyes disdainfully. Jeremiah mentions this. I have these biblical citations, Jeremiah 4 and chapter 23 and so on. There is some evidence that Jewish women dyed their nails of their fingers and toes with henna. Now, they didn't have, polish, fingernail polish like you ladies have today, but they would actually literally dye the nail using henna, a kind of a dye, all right? So they would do some of that, but generally they didn't think putting on cosmetics and painting one's face. They thought of that as sort of something that the pagans did in the Far East, and painted women were considered, and prostitutes. And again, please understand, I'm not saying that today. Customs do change, okay?
There's a time for everything.
There is a time for everything under the heavens. Yes. Okay. So I'm just saying what they thought then, okay? All right. Regarding perfume, they use a lot of it. Jewish women use a lot of it, much in the same manner as today. Common sources of perfume were frankincense and myrrh, aloes, nard, cinnamon, saffron, and so forth. And they would make up these, and they could buy some of them at the market, and just kind of like today. They would be made from different materials than today, but they were used. Hairstyles. As a general norm, women wore their hair long. Jewish women wore their hair long, and often they would braid it. The Talmud mentions that Jewish women also used combs and hairpins. It would seem that they generally, though, eschewed more elaborate hairstyles that they associated with Greek women and Assyrian women. And, I don't know if you've ever seen some of the ancient pictures of these ancient women. They wore these giant hairstyles that would just, go up 2 and 3 feet. So I'm talking about big hair, all right? And braids and lots of ornaments and gold woven in. They were very, very elaborate. And the Jewish women looked disdainfully at this as excessive. And again, that's then. I didn't say it's now. Okay, so there's nothing to forbid it. This is just their understanding. It would seem that they generally did not like these elaborate hairstyles of the Greek and Assyrian women. Although sometimes they often would wear a veil. This can hardly be considered a headdress, but it was a common thing among Near Eastern women. So they would often use their veil, sometimes in a traditional sense, but sometimes they would weave it in with their hair a bit and make it look attractive that way too. Okay, rings. Rings were not only worn on the fingers, but they were also commonly worn on the toes. So that was common. Now, men would wear some rings as well, but not on their toes. Okay, any comments or questions about clothing? Again, generally speaking, they would wear very simple, accessible, easy clothes that made sense for them. Pants were unknown. I don't know if you know this, but pants as we know them today are just a few hundred years old. And it's interesting, they become so widely worn today, but pants were originally associated with industry workers who couldn't wear robes because their robes would be caught up in machines and things. And they tended to be associated with common laborers. And so more patrician-like people, the wealthier and others who didn't want to associate themselves with the working class would look at wearing pants as kind of a step down. They would continue to... So as I say, up until about 300 years ago, pants were largely unknown. And this type of clothing, long flowing clothing, is very easy. It's easy to get in and out of. There's all kinds of advantages to it. However, when you're going to start working around machines and getting up and down things, climbing lots of stairs and things, you want your legs to be freer. And so pants came to be seen as a little more convenient. But on the other hand, they do tend to fit tight and they can be a little uncomfortable, and there's aspects about them that are unpleasant. So again, it's just differences, that's all. I think that it's fascinating in my own lifetime how I've seen how women have gone so dramatically to wearing pants, and that was almost unheard of when I was a youngster. Women almost never wore pants, at least not out, outside the house, but that's become obviously extremely common now. And that's happened, you all know that's happened in our lifetime. So there's been a lot of changed attitudes, about clothing in our own time. So yes, James, you had a question.
When they're... Is it hot?
Yeah.
But they've got wool tunics and stuff.
Okay. It looks hot. It does look hot. First of all, it's not always hot. There are cool times of the year in the Holy Land. And if you look at the trees in the background on this shot, of course, this is just a staged photo.
Right.
But it would be probably the cooler time of the month, probably in March or April. So it's still probably cool. Secondly, it's a low humidity, so that even when it gets hot during the day, at night it gets rather cool quickly. Secondly, remember, these clothes are very loose-fitting, and they flow and they breathe. A lot of air goes through them.
Oh, okay.
And that's the thing that we forget. And then the other thing would be, I would say those look like some fairly heavy woolen clothes, but they had lighter fabrics they wore in the hot months. And certainly the garments closest to them, their inner garments, were much lighter linens and things like that. So yeah. So he says that looks kind of hot to him. Yeah. Right. Okay. She's asking about riding horses and how can you do that when you got these kind of clothes on. Well, first of all, men almost never, except when they were at war, would ride horses in. Generally, women, when they did, I don't know if you can see this woman here, she's sitting side saddle. And that was almost, a woman in that era, up until really in your lifetime, a woman would never ride a horse. I mean, the way men do. It was just considered, well, anyway. So women always wore red roadside saddle. Okay? And so generally, men did not ride mules. When women needed to ride them, they would ride them side saddle. So now, occasionally, though, I hate to be too observant about these things, but I notice in this neighborhood a lot of women ride bikes, and I noticed that even when they wear dress, they still do okay with it. They can ride a bike. Of course, that's a little different than a horse. I understand that, but it is it is possible, with a loose enough kind of a garment to possibly, but again, generally, in that culture, a woman would never, ever mount a horse like a man would. Just wouldn't happen. Not in public. Okay. All right. Okay, then. I'm ready to go on to foods now. Okay. Now, regarding foods, generally speaking, the Israelites of the time of Christ were frugal eaters. Now, that's not because they were so virtuous, but food was just harder to come by. Frankly, until about 100 years ago, frugality in eating was more imposed than chosen. The food was more scarce, but here's the big thing, less convenient. Our big problem today with our weight is that food is so easy. Even some of you are old enough to remember, there was just a time when if you wanted to get breakfast, you had to make it. Whereas, now you just open up a package and throw something back and you're already caloried up for the day, you just throw something in the microwave, it takes you 10 seconds, right? Everything's convenient, just pop a soda pop and you're off on. But it was just getting meals prepared took a lot of work. And so that's when I say they were frugal eaters, it's not just that they were just such virtuous people, but rather it just took a lot of time to get food ready, and you just because of that you were more frugal. So food was more scarce, but it was less convenient. Its availability was also seasonable. Today we don't even think twice about going and getting roses in February. I mean, that would have been impossible 100 years ago. You just could not find roses in February. See, for Valentine's Day, right? And all the elements you had to make everything from scratch, including hauling water from wells and everything. So you see what I'm trying to show you is that it's not just that these were such virtuous, wonderful people who just knew how to eat properly and they just never gained an extra pound, but that food took a lot of time to prepare. You had to haul everything, including the water. You had to get it. You had to grind the grain from scratch and then knead the dough and bake the bread and, you know, that's just to get dinner ready. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we eat high cholesterol today.
Yeah, they were burning up.
I said throw it in the fire because it contains the essence, and the essence belongs to him.
Yeah. So she's talking about some of the foods that were offered in sacrifice. So again, all these are just ways of saying that there were kosher laws that limited some of the worst of foods that really fatten us up. Secondly, it was just harder to eat and so on. All right. Now, first of all, let's talk about some of the basic staples of their diet. Bread, basic staple. And the essential basic food. So basic was it that in Hebrew, to eat bread was equivalent to having a meal. In other words, let's go break bread. We sort of have that in English, right? Let's break bread. You know, it's so basic was bread to everything they ate that it was just the same as saying to have a meal or to break bread. Okay. Bread was treated with great reverence. And many rules existed to preserve that reverence. Any crumbs over the size of an olive were expected to be gathered and never simply discarded. You never threw bread out to the birds. Okay. Bread was to be reverenced. Bread was to be treated with respect. Bread was never to be cut, but always broken or torn or broken. Bread was, as I said, never to be cut, always broken. The poor ate barley bread. The rich ate the bread of wheat. Barley or wheat grains were the ground between two millstones, almost always by women, and this was done at home. Almost every home had, a millstone to grind the grain. And this was done at home. All right, from the flour, then, the dough was made and worked into kneading troughs. To make the heavy barley bread rise, women used very strong millets and barley yeast. Loaves were usually made round, such that one spoke of a round of bread, or simply a round. Because bread would become moldy very soon, one would only bake enough for a day or two. Okay? Again, we just take for granted all the preservatives and things that we pile into foods today. But they didn't have that stuff. So you couldn't bake a week's worth of bread. It wouldn't last. Not only would it go stale, it would get moldy. Okay? Now, so a basic element is bread. Now, you see some of it here in the picture. It's not the best. You'll see some better pictures of bread, but that looks kind of dry and toasty, if you ask me. But it's really more of a... It's more, though, you can sort of see it's, and on my screen it's a nicer thing. This sort of washes out some of the colors, but okay. Now, another huge staple was grain. Now, by the way, there is mention all throughout the scriptures of corn, but they didn't have corn like we have. Yeah. Corn was really something that was discovered in the New World, and they actually called it maize. And we've just taken into English to calling it corn. When you see the word corn in the Bible, you got to hear grain. They did not have corn. And by the way, even in Europe today, many people think of corn as something you feed animals. They kind of scratch their head at us Americans when they see us eating corn. Like, corn? Really? You eat corn? They think that that's something you throw to animals. Okay. Yeah, very cultural, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Now, corn, namely grain. The Bible mentions corn, but it has nothing to do with what we call corn today. Such a crop was unknown. Corn in the Bible refers to grain. All right. Now, another huge staple was milk. However, cow's milk was rare. In any case, it was not as much liked as the more common milk of ewe lambs or of goats. Since milk tended to spoil quickly, They use most of the milk to make cheese, and cheese making was very, very common. Okay. So now, honey was the big sweetener. You know, we think sugar, right? No, sugar was unknown to them. There was no sugar. That's again something that was discovered in the New World and in the Far East. It was a luxury. Even in this country, until about 100 years ago, the main sweetener would have been that heavy syrup. What was it? Molasses. Yeah, yeah. So, grain sugar was just almost unknown. So what did they use? They used honey to sweeten most things. The source of honey was bees. Also, they used some saps from various trees. The thickened juice of grapes, jelly in other words, were common sweeteners. So much honey was made in the Holy Land that it was able to be exported. They made a lot of honey in the Holy Land. Okay, eggs. Very few of them were eaten. You think, oh, they must have eaten a lot of eggs. Nope, they didn't eat many eggs. The thought of eating eggs was something that was brought into the Holy Land only from the outside, especially from the East. It tended to be a food only for the very wealthy, and indeed the eating of poultry at all seems to have come to Jewish regions only much later after the Babylonian captivity. So they did eat poultry at the time of Jesus, not a lot of it, but it seems to be something that only happened after the Babylonian exile, which was 580 BC. Okay. Vegetables. The diet of ordinary people included many vegetables. Beans, lentils came first on the list. Cucumbers were very much esteemed. Onions were also very popular. Okay. They didn't have quite the same variety of vegetables we had, but again, melons, leeks, in other words, onions, beans and lentils, and both green beans and other types of like limas and things like that were common in their diet. Meat. Meat was far less consumed than today. Big thing they ate was fish, right? But meat was less common. It was a food of luxury, and only the wealthy ate a great deal of it. Poor people never slaughtered an animal only for eating, for their own eating, except when there was a family feast. Generally, when such a feast approached, an older animal was chosen, fattened up by feeding it a lot of grain. You would fatten it for the slaughter, okay? And that made the meat more tender and juicy, right? Because remember, they used their animals as beasts of burdens. That's why you had an animal. You didn't raise an animal to slaughter it. You used an animal, and when it got older, sorry, old Bessie. I tell you what, though, your last 6 months are going to be great. We're going to feed you on lots of grain. And you're going to fatten you up, and then we're going to slaughter you, eat your meat, and then we're going to use your hide. All right. Such an animal spent its last months eating well, working little, so that its muscles were softer and fattier. Goats and lamb provided the most common meat, occasionally a calf or a cow. The animal was usually roasted. Chickens were scarce, much more scarce, though pigeons and turtle doves were cheap. So they eat more pigeon and turtle dove than chicken. Game was much sought after, but generally only the wealthy ate much of it. Deer and gazelle were considered kingly dishes, and peacock was a great delicacy. Tastes like chicken. All right. So again, a lot less meat. And again, it only came generally from, you know, older animals that were ready. They sort of served out their life, and now it was time. You'd use a lamb as long as you could for wool. And when the lamb started to get old and its wool was less desirable, time to fatten it up and use you know, kill it for the slaughter and use the meat. But you would never just, you know, raise an animal just to kill it for food. Okay, that just wasn't something they did. Now, fish, was much more common than meat. Bread and fish were a common meal. This is illustrated by the miracle of the loaves and the fishes, as well as the meal at the lakeside in Galilee. Isn't that a beautiful story? They're out there fishing, and Jesus is on the seashore. And get this, the Son of God is cooking breakfast for them. Isn't that great? He's got a fire, and he's cooking fish, cooking breakfast for them. Nice. Thank you, Jesus. The Sea of Galilee had great quantities of fish, and fish were also gotten from the Mediterranean Sea. Since fish soon turned bad, however, fish was often salted. The consumption of fish was so great that some of it had to be imported, so they ate a lot of fish. You're going to love this one. They ate a lot of locusts. Locust was a common dish. One of the more surprising forms of food was the locust. perhaps no stranger, though, than some of the things we eat today, like frog's legs and snails and live oysters. Now, that is just disgusting, eating a live oyster. I'm sorry. It's still alive. Yeah.
When Jesus gave him manna, where did he get the quail?
Okay. You're saying Jesus gave them manna. Actually, it was God the Father in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
The manna is, first of all, the word manna does not mean bread. Manna means, you got to scratch your head when you say it. What is this? That's what it means to you. Manu means, what is this? So whatever it was that was gathered on the desert floor for them, it doesn't help much that it says it was like coriander seed. Gee, thanks. But anyway, it seems to be something of a doughy thing that they could knead like bread and bake, you know, bake like bread. They could knead it like dough and bake it like bread, but it wasn't bread. It was manu. What is this? When you went to the cafeteria in your college. Mystery meat, right? Okay. But the manna, so we don't know, but it was for all effects, it was like a bread for them. But it wasn't normal bread. So that's the first thing. So where did God get it? Well, God made it out of nothing.
What about the quail?
Quail, it was an ordinary bird in that region, and God just had a lot of quail fly in from over the Red Sea and land, and they were easy pickings. But it was a regular bird, regular quail. I go out sometimes to Oklahoma with Ken Lewis, and we do a workshop out there. And one of the deacons out there, he loves to eat quail. That's his favorite dish. Yeah. Okay. It's a regular bird.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, locusts. Ancient Jewish documents claim that there were 800 different kinds of edible locusts. Sometimes they were cooked rapidly in salt water and had a shrimp-like taste and color. They had their heads and their legs were taken off. It's kind of like shrimp too today, right? You know, and sometimes they were dried in the sun, and after being dried, they would be ground down to a powder known as locust powder, which tasted rather bitter and was often mixed with flour to make a much prized bitter biscuit. Okay, so locusts were, again, often boiled like shrimp and then eaten like shrimp. And then if they weren't, they would be dried and sometimes ground to powder, used for spice. Okay. I know you say gross, but really, honestly, I bet you some folks hear some strange things. I'm serious. If you eat snails, I don't know what's wrong with you. It's a snail! Or frog legs, please. Tastes like chicken, Father. Okay. Now, butter was not that common. It was rare. But their main kind of substitute for butter was olive oil. Okay, a lot of olive oil. So abundant were olives and olive oils that it was exported from that region. Some olives were eaten directly, but most had the oil press from them in an oil press, often right at home. I'll show you an oil press in a minute. Olive oil was highly prized, and many passages in the Bible hold it up as a symbol of strength and of health. All right. Fruit. Fruit had an important place in people's food. They had many melons and figs, along with pomegranates, blackberries, and dates. Fruit was in abundance in the Holy Land, and it was also exported. They also ate a lot of nuts. Most common were walnuts, almonds, and pistachios that are grown in the region. Okay. As for seasonings, the ancient Jews liked to have their food seasoned. There was salt in abundance from the Dead Sea, which also helped preserve certain foods. You know, again, remember, before refrigerators, you all remember the old Smithfield hams? I mean, you could put that puppy on the counter, and 6 months later, it wasn't any different. They salted that thing, and woo! All right. Other common spices were mustard, capers, cumin, rue, saffron, coriander, mint, dill, rosemary, garlic, onions, and shallot. Pepper was scarce and very expensive, considered it an Eastern delicacy, as was cinnamon. So those were very rare and considered rich man's food. Without refrigeration, I already said to you, they would often salt or they would pickle. They did a lot of pickling and salting. And, you know, pickling is just kind of salting. It's just... Pork was absolutely forbidden, as was rabbit or any meat with blood still in it. Meat had to be carefully drained of all blood. Why? Well, because it was believed that life was in the blood and life belongs to God. You don't eat life. That's God's. So you drain the blood. Drinks. People usually drank water when it was pure. Spring water was preferred strongly over well water. There was milk that was drink. Vinegar diluted with water was also juice from pomegranates or dates, and perfumed fruit juice. Preferred fruit juices were pomegranate juice and date juice. Also, a kind of a light beer was made with barley and millets, all right? Miller Lite. Now, wine. Somebody mentioned wine. Big, important staple in the diet. Big, important staple. Wine was a very important staple. It is said that God himself first showed Noah how to make wine. Vineyards and grapes were very abundant in Israel, and grapes were occasionally eaten directly, but most of them went toward making wine. Psalm 103 says that wine is joy to man's heart. The book of Proverbs also describes that there should be wine in abundance for afflicted hearts. Ecclesiastes 31 says, the author wonders, what would life be without wine? I got these citations if you want. 31 verse. Indeed, the vine was a symbol for Israel in the scriptures. Since wine was considered sacred, it had to be kosher. That is to say, it had to be made only by Jewish hands. It was only red wine. They had no such thing as white wine among the Jews at that time. There's not even mention of white wine anywhere in the Bible. Wine was always spoken of as having the color of blood, and thus it was deep red or a purple color. They kept wine in either tall jars in their homes or in wine skins, and I'll show you a picture of a wine skin in a minute, made out of goat's hide with wooden stoppers. Wine was filtered before it was consumed, and like today, there were different qualities of wine, some drier, some sweeter, some considered inferior, some more desirable. They all drank wine out of metal goblets or earthenware mugs. Glasses were largely unknown to them, and they were scarce and expensive. Okay? So, now, wine in moderation was considered a great blessing, but the ancient Jews were also well aware that excessive wine could be dangerous. Scripture is full of warnings about drunkenness. Nevertheless, wine was often had in some abundance because water at that time wasn't pure. We just take for granted pure water, but you even know this. If you leave a cup of water sitting on your countertop a day or two, it's got stuff floating in it. Eventually, it's just a perfect place to grow bacteria. So, if you don't have purified water, you know, it tends to upset your stomach. You get all kinds of intestinal things. And so, remember how Paul wrote to Timothy? He says, "Come on, Timothy, take a little wine. Don't just drink water only, but take a little wine to settle your stomach. You know, kill that bacteria off." You know? Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that for sure. I've heard some of that, but I can't admit. I don't know. They still cried a lot. But there may be a truth to that. But I don't think they actually gave. It's probably more of a ceremonial taste. Because how are you going to get a baby to drink enough wine to get drunk and get, you know, kill the pain? Yeah. Okay. Well, the story's touching, but it sounds like a lie. All right. I don't mean you, but I mean, okay. So, again, the idea was that you would take a little wine to settle your stomach, and they didn't know of the existence of bacteria in those days. They just knew that it tended to settle your stomach and heal up stuff like diarrhea and some of the stuff that would afflict them with because of waterborne bacteria. Okay? So, all right.
What proof did this wine get you, like, nowadays, when we look at the Bible, we have 80 proof or 100 proof.
Yeah, he's asking what proof was the wine. Well, first of all, a couple thoughts. You know how in Mass the priest takes a little water and pours it into the wine? That's an ancient practice. People usually cut their wine. They didn't drink it straight like most of us. And so they tended to have heavy wine, but they would cut it with a lot of water. So they would, you know, pour a little bit of wine and cut it with water and dilute it, more like a wine cooler or a Zinfandel. It became more lighter that way. So they didn't get, they drank a lot of it, but they drank it mixed with water. And so the answer would be, it would probably be, you know, in the same range as ours, maybe a little bit even more, because they tended to be heavier, thicker wines. We have very filtered liquidy wines, whereas their wines were a little, I'm not saying they were as heavy as ketchup or anything, but they were heavier, and they, because of that, they cut them with water. Another question?
No, I was going to say, their wine, they didn't use yeast like we do, and they would make their wine with
Yeah, right. Yeah. But it had a good alcohol content. But it wasn't, as I say, they often cut a lot of it with water because they did drink a lot more. I mean, it was a staple at every meal. You'd have a little bit of wine. And we look at that like askance today. But again, it was just, there was a reason for it. It was medicinal. Okay. Now, by the way, their diet was also affected by the time of year. Remember, we have a lot of ways to preserve and ship foods today that they didn't. So let me just tell you a few of these times of the year where some of the common foods at each time of the year. All right, first of all, mid-September was plowing time, all right? But by October to November, it was the olive harvest. Grain was mainly harvested in November. I'm sorry, it was planted in November, and the rainy season began. There was a lot of barley, though, and grain available by March, as well as wheat. June, the figs came in. By July, grapes and vintage time. And that was the time of new wine in July and August. And then dates and figs and other fruits came in August. Okay, so a lot of extra fruits became available in the summer months. Right? Okay, let me just show you some of these slides that will give you. Up here on this particular slide, you can see some of the basic things. You've got bread, fish. You've got olives down here. You've got some almonds. And I can't see that for sure. It could be eggs, or it could also be some olives, but it could also be, what do you call them, chickpeas. Melons, figs, pomegranates, yeah. Okay, so we'll look at some more foods here. So this is just, again, lots and lots of different kinds of olives that they would harvest, and olives were just remarkably loved. Okay, now this is a kind of, notice how this piece of bread looks almost like a dish, and sure enough, that's what it was. It was common on a meal table to use a large round of bread like that for a dish, and then you would, you know, just pick these things up with your fingers. If something was kind of messy, you would have little sponge pieces of bread that you'd pick up with the bread and you'd eat all that together. So bread and lots of vegetables and so on. You don't see it in here, but there'd be some fish. But again, lots of very good healthy food. You know, it's just good, natural, healthy food. Yeah. So here we have some figs. Yeah, figs. And, you know, we don't eat a lot of figs in America, but in many parts of the world, we eat a lot of figs. Very sweet and big. So here's how they would take a meal, reclining. Okay, you see the vision here? Now some of them up against the wall, but basically people would recline on their elbow and eat with their right hand. And this was common. Okay. Low tables. Now that's just a very small table in someone's house, but larger banquets, they would have a U-shaped table, like the Last Supper. They would use a much... Where? I don't think so. Okay. Now, some utensils. They used, you know, a lot of earthenware and some tins and things, knives, but you'll notice there's no forks or spoons. They would not eat with forks and spoons. That just wasn't their way. Okay, this would be just some stoneware. And a tray in stoneware. And by the way, it's a little salty because that was actually, it's a drawing, but it was unearthed. You know, they've actually excavated, archaeologists have found these things, you see. Yes.
What would eat with the men?
Well, interesting question. In simple family meals, yes. But in larger meals, generally men would eat and women would eat in different shifts. Okay? And women would serve, yes. Now, however, it's interesting, the head of a household, when he had guests, would do the serving, but only in a formal way. You know, you women let us men go out and do the barbecue, but otherwise stay out of the kitchen. Some other utensils and things. Now, this would be a spoon, but not to eat with, but serving spoons or to mix things, but they didn't eat with them. Glassware, very rare among the Jewish people and considered quite elegant. They didn't use a lot of glassware. They might have had a couple little special glassware things, but they didn't have a lot. Okay. So mostly earthenware, stone, and metals
be their thing. This is the wineskin you're about to see. And now, they weren't always shaped like that. In fact, it's a little gross. Most wineskins, I didn't find a good picture, you'd actually see the goat, you know, the four limbs sticking out. And one of them would have a cork in it. But they just, but why let it go to waste, you know? You just sewed up the goat back, you just took the skin off and sewed it back up, kind of like a goat. And then you poured that wine in. So this would be more for traveling. When you were traveling, you could hang it around your shoulder. And then this could also be used for water, but basically they would use this either for water or wine when they were traveling. Now in the house, they would have larger jars or much larger goat skins that would be hanging from the wall in the kitchen. This is a goat skin. Almost always goat skin, yeah. Okay. All right. So we're going to go into marriage next and weddings. Any comments or questions now about food? Let me give you a quick typical meal menu. There'd be a salad of mint, rue, coriander, parsley, chives, green onions, lettuce, col root, thyme, caramel, green, I don't even know what all this stuff is, celery. The main course, roast lamb or fish, with a lot of, if there was roast lamb, they had a lot of mint sauce. I don't care for the taste of lamb. I just, and apparently they didn't either because they used a lot of mint sauce. All right. I just find it a funny, sulfury taste. Anyway, all right. Side dishes would involve chard, made into like a salad, or lentils and beans, mustard and green vegetable of some sort, maybe artichoke. Dessert would be maybe perhaps pear or dried pears. There would be possibly pomegranates or some other fruits and things for dessert. Okay. There would be dried apples sometimes mixed with toasted sesame. Okay. Basically, how were meals taken? I've already talked to you about that, so we'll leave that now. Just maybe a couple quick thoughts that I may have mentioned. I'm just quickly looking at my notes. I basically said it all. So let's go on to marriage and family. All right, marriage and family. Now, the word family had a wider meaning then than it does now. The Hebrew word ah, which in Aramaic ah, which would mean to refer to those who were brothers and sisters, half brothers, cousins, even near relations. So we use the word brother and sister in English often in a strict sense, someone who shares the same, at least the same mother or the same father, or ideally both. but brother, sister was much vaguer in Hebrew and Aramaic. It could mean brothers, cousins, half-brothers. It could mean, so in other words, even as I can use the term loosely and say my brothers and sisters, you know, obviously I'm not saying we all have the same mother and father, literally. But you see the idea. So just so you know that family was a wider notion. However, so very often in homes or in towns and villages, there'd be large networks of relationships and extended family networks that were insisted upon and also was essential for survival. In fact, I'm just going to tell you right now, in our culture now, the family is in crisis. But I'm going to tell you where I think it first went into crisis, when the extended family started to break down. We all started running out to the suburbs and wanted to get as far away from each other as fast as we could. And we went out to these suburbs and, you know, and most of you older than I am remember a time when, you know, you grew up in a neighborhood and your sisters and cousins and aunts were all around the corner and up the street. And by God, if you got out of line, 80 people knew about it, you know, in half a second. And then we started to divide out and the nuclear family, of course, went into crisis because, you know, when you're trying to raise a family, you sometimes get sick, or you need a little extra money. Now, my brother and sister-in-law have 8 kids, but the grandma's right up the street. So they're able to, you know, rely on her. It works. But when you don't have the extended family, the nuclear family is often in a lot of stress, okay? So anyway, it goes on to say here, so, of course, marriage is at the heart of the family, and the very first order that God gave Adam and Eve was that a man should leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two of them should become one, and that they should increase and multiply, all right? So what's God's definition of marriage? One man for one woman in a faithful, stable, clinging, fruitful relationship. Why should the marriage be long? Why should it be lifelong? Why should they cling? Well, because children. You know, marriage has its structure not for the adults, it has it for the sake of children. Now, we have developed a very twisted notion in the modern times that marriage exists for the sake of the happiness of adults. That is not correct. There is nothing in the Bible that says, go and just be happy. I hope your spouse makes you happy, and I don't doubt that marriage is a way to be happy, but the reason marriage is the way it is, and the reason it has a structure, the reason there should be a man and a woman, and one man and one woman, and that they should stick it out, is because that's what's needed for children to exist, and then to grow up well. See? And all this stuff today, we've been indulging in single mothers and single fathers, and who cares, and different combinations, and Heather has two mommies, and none of that's good for kids. None of that's good for kids. So, and this, the latest twist in this gay marriage thing, I mean, let's be honest, we heterosexuals have been misbehaving and redefining marriage for 50 years now. We've been getting divorced and contracepting and fornicating and not having getting married at all and having babies every which way except in the proper way. And then all of a sudden the gay community steps up and says, it looks like marriage is just about two adults being as happy for as long as they please and then they just go their way. Well, then why not us? See? So after all of our years of misbehavior, suddenly they've called the... Now, I'm not saying I approve of what they're doing. I'm just saying that we have to understand... In the heterosexual community, we've been goofing off and playing around for 50 years. That is not what God says. See? God says a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife, and the two of them become one flesh. And then he says to them, be fruitful and multiply. Right? So, anyway, sermon ended. Now, in the earliest years of Israel, there seems to have been some tolerance for polygamy, okay? But it was a departure from what God had set forth. And so every time you see stories in the Bible about polygamy, there's trouble. And it isn't the women. It's the sons of the different mothers. The whole story of Joseph and how his brothers sold him into slavery. And that's different wives and different mothers. And who's your daddy? Who's your mama? And then likewise, we have different aspects of Gideon killed 70 of his brothers. So, you know, Gideon had 70 sons by different wives. And at the end of it, Zerubbabel rounded up all of his brothers for a party and killed every one of them. And said, I'm in charge now. See, that's the kind of stuff that happens with polygamy. So the Bible does record it, but it says it's always trouble. So by the time of Jesus, polygamy had largely vanished. All right? Now, let's talk of then how did people get married and so on. Okay? So, in the earliest years, as I say, we see marriage took place very early for ancient Jews. Most rabbis proposed 18 as the most suitable time for men, but most got married a bit younger by the time of Jesus, more like 16 or 17. Especially when war was less common, men got married younger. Young women married and almost as soon as they were physically ready for marriage, approximately age 13 or 14. Now, they might get married at 13, but wouldn't leave their father's house until they were 14. So usually they would be married, but it's called betrothal. They were actually technically married, but she didn't leave for a year to go and live with her husband. Okay. In most cases, marriages were arranged by the parents for their children. However, there were exceptions to this. And arranged marriages were seldom forced on young people who had absolutely no attraction or interest in one another. Nevertheless, the insight of the ancient world, even in many places today, was that marriage was not so much about love and romance as it was about survival. Why did people get married until about 100 years ago? To survive. You know, we don't think like that today. Why did people get married? To survive. There was no Social Security. Your children were your Social Security. Are you pregnant? When you got old and decrepit, there were no nursing homes, there was no check. You change your children's diapers? They change yours. You can no longer chew your food because you got no teeth, so they break it just like you did when they were young. Okay? You got married to survive. You had children to survive. Okay? We decided that love and romance... Now, I'm not trying to tell you to marry somebody you don't care about and can't stand. I didn't say that. But I'm just going to say to you that we've gotten into this idea that, oh, how awful it must be, arranged marriage, how terrible that must be, and, oh, it's awful. Listen, even in most parts of the world today, that's not the way marriage is done. families arrange marriages because marriages are about families coming together, not just two people. And not only that, we've used love and romance as the basis for marriage for several hundred years now in the West. How's that working for us? Do you hear the word motion and emotion? Now, look, I hope you get married and always love your spouse to the day you die. But, I mean, feelings have their cycles, right? And if that's all you're getting married about, you're in trouble. So you see, the idea is that marriage is more deeply rooted in a basic human need to survive. It's not good for the man to be alone. I'll make a suitable helpmate for him. And then, you know, he made Eve, and then he said, and then be fruitful and multiply. So, okay. So, in most cases, marriages were arranged. All right, we talked about that. Nevertheless, the inside of the ancient world, and this may seem strange to us, but you got married to survive. And not only, it was not merely individuals who married, but families that came together in mutual support. All right, families came together. Okay? Beauty and romance, while noted in Israel and considered wonderful and pleasant, were also noted to pass. You know, beauty, charm, beauty is fleeting. What does the Book of Proverbs say? Charm is deceitful, and beauty is fleeting. You know, and so on. So, you have to have relationships more deeply rooted than in passing things. All right. So, by the way, there's a wonderful. Remember that story from Fiddler on the Roof? Tevye says to his wife, "When you first laid eyes on me, what did you think of me?" "Oh, Tevye, you don't want to know." Over the years, we've gotten close. You know, love, loyalty kind of sets up and have children in common, you know. So you see, there's more to marriage than just, wowza! Okay. So when the future bride had been chosen for the young man, either by his parents or more rarely by himself, there preceded a period of what was called 1 year called betrothal. During this time, the couple still lived apart, and the delicate, often protracted negotiations went back and forth between the families as to the questions of dowries, etc. Now, it says here the groom or his family paid the dowry, and the father of the bride. Now, why? Well, he was losing a worker. Women are great workers, and you know, when your daughter goes out of your home, you lose a worker, so you're remunerated. Okay. The payment was made in lieu of the loss incurred as a working member of the household went forth. It was also understood that money should be set aside for a woman in case her husband might die prematurely. All right, marriage ceremonies. When the period of the betrothal was finished, all the arrangements were at last made and signed, now came the wedding day. Now, it wasn't really a wedding day. Weddings actually extended over a period of 5 to 7 days, routinely. Autumn was the best time for marriages. The harvest was in. The vintage was over. Minds were free and hearts were at rest. It was a season when evenings were very cool and delightful, and it's very agreeable to sit up late at night in the villages, which were small, and in the smaller villages, the whole village would usually gather for the weddings. And there'd be a number of weddings in every village in the autumn. And people look forward to wedding season. It's a wonderful time of feasting and enjoyment, okay? Just put up another slide here. Okay. On the evening of the beginning of the wedding feast, the bridegroom, accompanied by his friends, went to fetch the bride from the father's house. He would wear a particularly splendid clothes and sometimes would even wear a crown, and the procession was formed under the direction of the bridegroom's friend, who acted as the master of ceremonies and remained by his side throughout the rejoicing. Okay? The bride, having been fetched, was carried in a litter, some kind of a big, you know, thing to be carried in procession. She was beautifully dressed, and along the way, the people sang wedding songs that were traditionally known and largely drawn from the Song of Songs in the Bible. For example, from the Song of Songs verse, it would often sing this song: "Who is this coming up from the wilderness like a beautiful column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, and made from all the spices of a merchant? Who is this beautiful bride?" See, when the procession reached the bridegroom's house, his parents uttered a traditional blessing drawn from the scriptures, and after the prayer, the evening was passed in games and dancing, and the bride in which the bridegroom took part. But the bride withdrew with her friends and bridesmaids to another room or another house nearby in the village assigned for her. Now the very next day, the day of the wedding, came, and once again there was a general rejoicing, a sort of holiday in the village, and there was a meal toward the end of the day, and the men and the women were served apart. Then the time, when the time for giving, there was a time for giving of presents, etc. And the bridesmaids then stood about the bride, all dressed in white, and there were usually about 10 of them. And the bride sat under a canopy, and there were traditional songs and blessings that were recited during this time. And then during this time, in the evening, the groom would then arrive. And while the exact ritual and the words are not certain, there seems to have been a dialogue between the bride and the groom, recorded in the Song of Songs. So let's make sure you got all these details. So the actual night before the wedding, the bride would be fetched and brought near to the groom's house. They weren't going to be together that night. It's kind of like rehearsal dinner night, if you will, in our modern setting. And they would have a great set of rejoicing, and then the men would go in one direction, and the women and the groom's family and would go here, and the bride and her family and friends, and they'd have separate parties. The next day, more feasting. By the evening, though, the groom would come and fetch the bride. I'm sorry, the bride would be gathered where the wedding would take place, and the groom would make an entrance, okay? He would make an entrance in the evening, just after dusk, okay? Now, it says here, when the groom arrived, he and she would say a dialogue that went something like this. She would cry out, saying, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes, and your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers." And the groom would respond, "Arise, come, my beloved, my beautiful one. Come with me, my dove, in the cleft of the rock, in the secret hiding places, in the mountainside. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely." Beautiful, beautiful dialogue, huh? Yeah.
Go back. When you read earlier, a marriage between a man and a woman, why did God let Moses have two wives?
Well, I sort of went through that. I'll talk to you later about that, okay? With the problem of polygamy.
Yeah.
He let it, but he wasn't happy about it.
Okay.
No, it wouldn't happen. Okay. Okay. Now that the couple was together, all the men and the women were also together, and then some synagogue official or leader would be here, and see, this is kind of where we are now. The bride and the groom are now together. They've made this little dialogue, and all the family are gathered. There's some synagogue officials here that are ready to give the blessing. They would come together under a canopy, and there'd be certain songs. You see the guy playing a flute there and some drums and a little slight, what they call a kind of a small harp, called a sitara, and they would be singing and playing and the music, okay? And then there would be the blessing and some sort of exchange of vows, but basically the blessing of the synagogue or the temple officials. And so we see all of that. It says here, after that, it says, later on that evening, the couple would vanish and the marriage would be consummated. And the celebrations often went on for several more days. The couple did not go away on a honeymoon, but they remained these days, sharing the merriments and the songs and the dancing under the star-strewn skies. Okay, that's the basic kind of rituals related to a wedding. Now, notice again, it's different from ours in this sense that, first of all, we do everything on one day. They would do it over a period of days. Secondly, you think weddings are expensive today. But also, couples had, I mean, not just couples, but everybody had wedding garments. There were special garments you wore during weddings. And that's why you might remember one of the parables Jesus tells. There was a man who was brought into a wedding, but he wasn't properly clothed. And the king came and said, "Why are you not wearing the proper clothing for a wedding?" And the man had nothing to say. The king said, "Throw him out. Throw him out." It was considered very insulting and rude to go to a wedding feast without the proper kind of clothing, all right? And exactly what that clothing looked like wasn't entirely clear, there were special clothes, and even the poor had them. And sometimes, if someone was very poor and couldn't afford, they were expected to be provided. Okay, but nobody would go to a wedding without proper clothing. Okay. It's just another quick picture of a wedding feast here. They're just having fun, a little dancing. There's a couple right there. And look at that guy. Hello. He's probably the best man saying, "My work is finally done." And so it was the groom who made the entrance and so on. Okay. Well, it looks like our young folks are coming back. And what time is it? Close to 9? Oh, is it after 9? Oh, 10 of 9. Okay. Well, we'll talk a little bit more then next week. I got to do a lot next week to kind of wrap things up. Next week, I want to talk a little bit about their basic jobs. What were some of the jobs they did? Everything from field work to carpentry to being a merchant. Some people made wine. There were all kinds of different trades. So we'll look a little bit at those. We'll also look at a little bit about family life and domestic work. Women did a lot of work around the home. So we'll look at some of the things they did. And then I want to talk a little bit about their understanding of time, how they understood time. And then finally, the end of all things. We're going to look at some of their death and burial practices. And then the tragic end of Israel in the Jewish war in 70 AD. We're kind of looking at the end of an era as we look at these slides, okay? So any last-minute quick questions? Or we have one more class. I hope you can make it. And like I said, we'll look at some of those things next time, all right? And you have your outline.
Thank you.